So, yeah, go ahead.
So, Steve, this is Chris Seifer. You know, one of the things that we are doing is looking, in accordance with the statute, is looking at the role of derivatives may or may not have played in the financial crisis, whether as a contributing cause or as a propagating mechanism. So we have been contacting lots of folks like yourself that could give us their opinions on those matters. And that's basically the main first question that we'll ask you. But before we get to that, just so we have it in our record, could you just give us your educational background and a short summary of your work background?
Sure. The shortest would be that I got an undergraduate degree in economics from William & Mary in 1969, a PhD from Stanford in economics in 1973. I was a professor at Berkeley for 10 years after that.
Go Bears.
And for, sorry?
Go Bears.
Oh, okay.
I'm from Cal, too. Sorry.
No, our problem was every year we went to the big game to try to root for Cal, and as soon as Stanford, as soon as the Stanford band started playing, we reverted immediately back to being students at Stanford. So I never was able to root for Cal. It was a very awkward 3 hours every year.
Right.
After I left Berkeley in 83, I was on Wall Street for 20 years, and largely I had two kind of major activities. One, I was on the asset management side of the business, and two, I was on the derivative side, both in building derivatives desks, selling derivatives, building sales efforts and derivatives, and managing fixed income trading desks and derivatives desks. And then I retired in the summer of 2002.
Okay. And who did you work for on the street during those 20 years?
Okay, I worked for... it's an interesting set of firms. I worked for Lehman, Bankers Trust, AIG Financial Products, and First Union Wachovia, all of which are gone.
So
derivatives really are a weapon of mass destruction.
Well, I think that in the case of I guess AIGFP isn't gone. That would be unfair. I don't know. We could talk about each of the four. I don't think derivatives had anything to do with the fact that Wachovia...
No, I was being facetious. I'm sorry.
I think it was for one reason Bankers Trust got bought up by Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Absolutely. I think derivatives are at the heart of the reputation risk that Bankers Trust took, undervalued, and wound up losing big on. Derivatives... I'm going to ask you all to define derivatives, since this is a recorded conversation and you're asking me to comment on them. Derivatives were certainly, in the public's eye, a factor in Lehman's demise. AIGFP is purely a derivative shop, and Wachovia First Union basically no longer exists because of reasons totally unrelated to derivatives, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay, so that's my background, and I should probably let you ask questions.
Sure. Well, let me, in terms of defining derivatives, at least the way we're looking at it are sort of, you know, the five categories of derivatives that you see in the Bank for International Settlements. I don't think we're talking about, you know, structured product per se, but, you know, interest rate swaps, commodity derivatives, foreign exchange derivatives, credit derivatives, and equity derivatives. Those are the ones we're looking at. So, that's how I think we're defining it.
We're referring to structured securities as securities.
Right.
So cash CDOs, security, residential mortgage-backed security, no matter how many times it's tranched as a security. And although there are similarly looking synthetic CDOs that are, because they're synthetic, it's a derivative, although it may be on essentially the same referenced items.
And so I'll ask you the... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So I'll ask you the question we start out asking everybody after we get their background that we're talking to, and that is just generally, can you give us your opinions on whether derivatives, any types of derivatives, played a role in the financial crisis, and if so, how?
Okay, that's not the question I was expecting, but I'll answer it.
Okay.
I think you just answered what you consider derivatives to be, and I would say that interest rate swaps, equity derivatives, currency derivatives had little if no impact on the 07-08 crisis, in my opinion.
Okay.
And I haven't seen anybody claim they did. Anybody. Even the most ignorant politicians I haven't seen claim that those types of derivatives caused the crash. Credit default swaps, we would have to focus on. I think the credit default swaps were a major contributor to the crisis. And I would, and I think that people view the CDO structures, let me not say people, I think journalists and some and the public lump the CDO contributions into the derivatives contributions, and I agree with you all that that's a totally different phenomenon.
Okay, so can you explain a little on how you think CDS were a major contributor to the crisis?
Yeah. Another way to, can I interject for a second? Another way to express the question is instead of saying what caused the crisis, to also ask what role did derivatives play in the crisis, which might not be as an initial cause or catalyst, but might have played a role in spreading or amplifying the effects of the crisis.
Okay. Again, I don't think that interest rate derivatives, currency derivatives, or equity derivatives contributed to, help spread, or exacerbated the crisis. I think that credit default swaps did, and I think that subprime mortgages and CDO structures did, and I have a particular reason that I haven't seen in the press why they did, and we can come back to that later. I mean, I'd like to put it out there so you all have at least heard it, but it's not responsive to your question. Credit default swaps have two contributions to the crisis, in my opinion. One is that it enabled the securities firms to believe that the risks were less. If they were buying credit default swaps on the mortgages that they were holding, they believed that their risks were at least partially mitigated, and so that enabled the product to grow considerably from sometime in 05 till the summer of 07 or the summer of 08, and I think that contributed a great deal to people's sense that things were okay. They then contributed directly to the crisis because for reasons that are absolutely baffling, AIGFP wrote derivatives on CDS credit default swaps on the structures in of a size that they couldn't possibly handle the risks of. And it's inexplicable to me as a former employee of AIGFP as to how, and I'll use Joe Cassano's name, who's a former colleague of mine and I know him pretty well, how Joe Cassano could write $50-odd billion worth of credit default swaps, not hedge it at all, and then claim publicly that he was never going to have to pay out a dime on any of it. I mean, that's a major contributory to the crisis. And then there's the issue of however many billions of credit default swaps each of the securities firms and banks bought from AIGFP. The question that I have, and that I don't think anyone will ever get an answer to, is at what point, and let's use Goldman Sachs as an example.
Okay.
Goldman Sachs believed that they were hedging their own risk by buying credit default swaps from a AAA counterparty, namely AIGFP. At what point did they ask themselves, if we own X billion of this, how much is AIG writing?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody at Goldman asked that question at some point, and it would be really fascinating to know what answer they came up with.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, please, if you'll keep this conversation confidential, will you? So I will tell you some things. You know, we are actually looking at having a hearing at the end of this month, June 30 and July 1st, and coincidentally with your comments, on derivatives and using two institutions as case studies, surprise, surprise, Goldman and AIG. So we have obviously in the last, you know, 4 or 5 weeks been talking to people, reviewing documents and, you know, both public and private on those two companies and looking at some of those issues. And while... Go ahead.
Okay, let me... I mean, I was a derivatives... I was there at the beginning of derivatives in 83, but long before they were ever called derivatives, and there's actually an article in the New York Times on me and a group of other academics who went to Wall Street in 83 and 84, and basically at the heart of creating these markets and called us pioneers and all the rest. And I spent I'll tell you this. I mean, I spent 20 years talking to clients, talking to the Dick Falls of the world, creating derivatives businesses for them, pounding the desk and saying that no trading room executive and no bank executive would ever take risks that they didn't understand that were of a size that would threaten the existence of their company or their desk. And then after I retired in the summer of 02, I continued giving public speeches and saying that up until 07. And since 07, I am forced to admit that I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just dead wrong. It was incomprehensible. What happened from 05 to 08 is incomprehensible to me, having been on the inside for 20 years. And again, the question to me to ask people at Goldman is, if you had X billion dollars of quote-unquote insurance with AIGFP, did you ever ask yourself, how much of this stuff are they writing and are they good for it? Do I really have insurance here? And obviously we now know from everything we've read that's public that the weekend of September 15th, when they were all sitting in a room together, sometime on that weekend they discovered that the amount that was being written by AIG was more than they could possibly pay off. And it came to the attention of, you know, of Bernanke and Geithner and Paulson, roughly around the same time that it came to the attention of Merrill and B of A and Goldman. And why weren't those guys asking that question 2 years before?
Or the OTS, yeah, since they were the consolidated regulator.
That's the incomprehensible part to me. I mean, set aside what we may or may not get into in this conversation, that AIG may or may not have been well run, and the companies may or may not be well run. The companies should be better run, and the board should do a better job, and CEOs should do a better job, and trading desk people should do a better job. Set aside all that. But why wasn't that basic question being asked? Because all of us heard for our whole career, for 25 years, that, you know, oh my gosh, derivatives are a problem, derivatives are going to destroy the world, Warren Buffett calls them weapons of mass destruction, derivatives are terrible because of the interlinkages of all the firms. And we all said, that's not a problem because our credit guys will never let us be exposed to any one firm in an amount that would threaten us. Part and parcel of that is asking your counterparties, how much of this have you written? We have as much as we can handle. Are you going to be able to pay this off? And those are the questions that market professionals ask each other, but for some reason stopped doing in the last decade. And I think major contributory to the crisis.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say if somebody said, well, look, the reason we wrote $50 billion of CDS on the super senior tranches of multi-sector CDOs And in fact, let's go a little further. Let's say $80 billion, because that's what the number was.
Was it
80? It was 80 by mid 07. It's up
is
to
that
80.
Confidence for me, or can I now know that?
I think you can now know that. I think that's public. I think that's reported in the public filings. So that number you don't have to keep confidential.
That's the CDO.
The of the ballpark $500 billion notional amount of credit derivatives, $80 billion, were on super senior tranches of multi-sector CDOs sometime in 2007. In the June, July, August 2007 timeframe when the first margin call came in. But some might say that the reason we did that is because we thought, mistakenly, that the collateral supporting those super senior tranches only included no more than 5, 10, 15% of subprime assets, and they were only later to learn that it was much worse than that. Would your opinion still be the same if the exposure was $80 billion, but the types of assets behind it were not as so concentrated in subprime, mid-prime, Alt-A, HELOC, and that kind of product?
I'm not sure that I understand your question. My answer assumed all that.
Okay.
So my answer, yes.
Well, one of the things, and this is a confidential part, one of the things we've learned is that these, and this is, some of this is confidential, some of it's not, because some of it was reported in The Big Short, is that going to late 05, the belief within AIGFP was that, you know, only 5 to 10 to 15% of the collateral supporting these CDS that they wrote on the super senior tranches was subprime, but they came to learn that, in fact, the amount of subprime, Alt-A, mid-prime, et cetera, was actually upwards of, you know, 70, 80, 90% on these deals. And that is when the company actually decided to stop writing CDS on these types of multi-sector CDOs, although they had to comply with some commitments and keep writing through probably mid-06. So they did stop writing once they found that out. Now, I can tell you that the information that we can tell was there for the company to see how much of it was in actuality subprime, Alt-A, et cetera. I still haven't figured out how they didn't know, since it's in the documents. And obviously, okay, I think they did know.
This gets directly to what I believe is the cause of the crisis, which is a different answer to how the derivatives contribute to it. But can I go to what I think is the bottom line?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, I agree with everybody who says that it was everybody's fault. I mean, it's going to be very, very hard to find, you know, one bad guy, and you guys are sophisticated enough that you know that. I mean, the people who were lending money to people who they know could never pay back the loans are at fault. People who were borrowing money they knew they never could pay back are at fault. You know, Congress for saying, let's bring the American dream to the next group of people who can't afford it, are at fault for not identifying the fact that there were going to be costs to that, and maybe you could do the public policy correctly by subsidizing it and making the cost up front rather than waiting for a crisis to find out what the cost was and find out who's going to wind up doing it. You know, all of those are at fault. The rating agencies, in my mind, are at the top of the list of the people at fault, because the rating agencies just basically took the securities firm's word for it. And people are pointing out they were also taking their money, and set that aside as part of the problem. But I think all of those are symptoms of what went wrong. And here's what I think really happened, and I haven't seen anywhere. Derivatives guys are at the heart of creating the CDOs. Derivatives guys are the quote-unquote rocket scientists at the heart of creating those CDOs. And I assume that one or all three of you are sophisticated enough to know how you price a CDO. you price the CDO with looking at, or any option for that matter, by looking at the underlying, by looking at the what the defaults are likely to be, and looking at what the foreclosures are likely to be, and looking at what the volatility of the prices are likely to be of the underlying assets. Derivatives guys are the ones who generate the resulting values of every tranche of a CDO, and in fact of every option they have a right. The kinds of people that we, and then after I retired, they continued hiring, the kinds of people who are at the hearts of those are, they're PhDs in physics from Russia. They're PhDs in physics from MIT. They're PhDs in math from Carnegie Mellon. They're PhDs, some of them are PhDs in finance, and some of them are MBAs. They're really, really, really bright people who know the arithmetic and the mathematics underlying how you create complex securities, mm-hmm. but they don't know anything about credit. They don't know anything about making a loan. They don't know anything about what goes into pricing a loan. And if you stop and think about that, they basically, if you could go back in time and interview the people who were pricing and creating the CDOs on Goldman's desk or on B of A's desk or on Wachovia's desk or any desk, and go into them and ask them, what do you think the foreclosures are going to be and the defaults are going to be on this basket of mortgages that you're putting into this CDO, and what are the resulting prices on each of the tranches? And they would show you a graph of what the foreclosures and defaults have been over the previous 20 years.
Right.
And then if you told them, which somebody did, that, well, these are subprime, and these are a different class of borrowers, they would say, well, then maybe the defaults and the foreclosures are going to go from 2% to 3%, but the worst they ever saw was 6%. So if you ask them to do a stress test on those CDOs, they would tell you, well, maybe it could get as bad as 6%. And obviously, you've read all the books that are out now. When some of these hedge fund guys sort of peeling back the onion and looking into this, mm-hmm. and actually going out to Golden West and going out to what are the names of some of the other mortgage people? I've forgotten that.
Oh, Fremont, New Century, Countrywide. I mean, all that.
And found out what they were doing, and realized the foreclosures and the defaults of these things were quite likely going to be in excess of 50%. That's when they realized that this was a real mess. And there were people at Goldman and at Moody's and at Wachovia and at B of A and at Wells Fargo and at Golden West who did know that the underwriting standards had been totally compromised in all these new batch of subprime loans, and that the underwriting standards have been destroyed. And there were people, this is the part that should make the hair stand on the back of your neck, okay, and the hair stand up on your arms. Mm-hmm. There were people in every one of these organizations, especially Moody's and S&P and Fitch, who knew that the underwriting standards had collapsed and that the prices that the derivatives guys, in their ignorance, the underlying assumptions that the derivatives guys were making were ludicrously wrong. Now, what I came to realize, this wasn't until 07 or 08, because I'm not in the markets, and I didn't have the benefit of what some of the hedge fund guys were saying, and I wasn't talking to credit guys. But what suddenly occurred to me is, the question that I ask is, and let's take a giant step backwards, I can understand why banks will sell a security for $100 to somebody that they know is only worth $90. And I think all of us on this call understand that. People sell things for more than they think they're worth. That's how they make a living. And that's where the Goldman guys got stuck in the last Senate hearings, is they kept trying to find a nice way to say that what we do for a living is we make money.
Right.
And the senators were saying we're not understanding what they were trying to say. But it's a slippery slope. I mean, if you're used to selling securities for $100 that are worth $90, and suddenly you're selling securities that are worth $100, they're only worth $80. You got there over time. And when I suddenly looked and realized that they were selling securities to institutional investors for 100 that were only worth 20, I said, you know, somewhere a line got crossed. You know, I can see how it happened, but what I couldn't see is how on earth could they sell it to themselves? How on earth did the derivatives desk sell securities worth 100? I'm sorry, it was for 100 that were worth 20 to Dick Fult. How could the desk at Lehman sell something to Dick Fult for 100 that was only worth 20? And how could the guys at Goldman sell it at the top of the house? And it was then that I realized what had happened. They didn't know it was worth 20. The derivatives guys were still working under 5, 6, 4, 7% foreclosure and default assumptions. And the credit guys knew that those were ludicrous. And no one in the organizations was communicating that. I wasn't there, and so I'm now speculating, but the only explanation for how they could be holding that paper can only have two parts. Number one, initially they didn't know how bad it was. And number two, they were able to buy a credit default swaps to hedge themselves. But that's what I think caused the crisis, that there was no communication within the firms. The people producing the CDOs literally did not know and had no way of knowing. They're not credit guys. And they had no way of knowing that the underwriting standards out in San Diego and El Paso, Texas, and Tucson and Tulsa, the underwriting standards for making loans had completely collapsed. And the people who understood that didn't understand the importance of it on a derivatives desk. And no one was communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think the cause of the crisis was. And I think that the role of credit default swaps was that once people started figuring it out, whether they were hedge funds, or whether they were the CEO of Goldman Sachs, or whether they were, you know, the head of the trading desk at Merrill Lynch, they found a AAA person who was willing to insure them against it. And the demand became staggering as the number of people who found out the mispricing grew exponentially. And so the credit default swaps enabled it to keep growing and put off the day of reckoning by 2 years.
How do you think about 2 years?
Well, when did if I read all this stuff correctly, didn't Hank Greenberg leave in March of 05?
That's correct.
And didn't Cassano say that's when he started writing more credit default swaps around then, bizarrely? And then wasn't it not until December of 07 that he stopped?
Actually, some of that's right, some of that's based on my incomplete review of the documents is not right. They certainly increased the volume of CDS in the 05 time frame. At the end of 05, they decide to stop, continue to write though throughout 06, just because even though they weren't legally binding commitments, they had, you know, made business commitments to do it and weren't going to go back on their word. Oops. But by from the documents we've seen so far, for the most part, AIGFP stops writing CDS on this stuff in the fall of 06 and had told the street that they were going to stop writing in as early as January and February of 06, so they knew it was coming. And one of the things we're hearing and in the process of trying to confirm is that, you know, while the MBIAs and the AMBACs of the world may have written some CDS, really nobody stepped in, and that a lot of the banks just started, retaining more of the super senior tranches without protection. And then two, what we're looking at is in terms of the mezzanine tranches, whether that just increased the whole CDO square cubed, et cetera, throwing more and more stuff into additional CDOs and having it, you know, keep going that way.
So Joe wrote $80 billion from late winter of 07 to fall of 06, that's astonishing.
I don't think, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I mean, they weren't at zero, you know, at the beginning of 05.
Right.
You know, so, but I believe that the pace and the volume of CDS written in 05 and even in that period in 06 was higher than in the Greenberg times.
So here's what I believe. Let's suppose we lived in an alternative universe where Joe didn't write any of those CDS. So we're in March of 05, mm-hmm. and there is nobody to write those. Then in that alternative universe, that's about the time people are discovering that these tranches are terribly, terribly mispriced. I mean, basically, what caused Joe to be able to write this stuff, or AIG to be able to write this stuff, was there was a huge demand for it. And the huge demand was coming as more and more people understood that there was a mispricing. So if those who understood there was a mispricing couldn't find any way to insure themselves, then the market would have slowed down and stopped roughly at that point, and the market pricing would have turned down as people were desperately trying to sell it and offload it. So the crisis would have come when did Lehman fail? September of 08?
Lehman goes down September of 08. Bear, of course, goes down March of 08, and you've got those initial liquidity crises in August of 07.
I think all that happens sort of 2 years earlier, because no one can find buyers for something that everybody realizes was terribly overpriced. And so it's just a question of when the pricing starts going up. Prices go down because suddenly there are no buyers and everybody's trying to sell. And basically AIG held that off for 2 years by insuring the sellers. Now, for those 2 years, of course, the total size dramatically increased as well, partially because of all the synthetics are being created. So what would have happened in that alternative universe is the crash would have come 2 years earlier and it wouldn't have been as severe. That's another way of saying what Bernanke and Greenspan and all central bankers always say, which is that when you get a tulip market, when you get a market like that, the longer it goes on, the bigger the crash. But I don't think CDS has caused the crash. I think they caused it to happen later and caused it to be more severe. Whenever you get a bubble, the bubble, whatever it is that's enabling the bubble to keep going, pushes the crash out further and causes it to be bigger.
Right.
That's not very precise, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
And yeah, but the cause of the mispricing was this staggering information asymmetry. And the place where it should have been caught, in my opinion, and nobody's paying me for my opinion, so but the place where it should have been caught, in my opinion, is at the rating agencies. I mean, it should have been caught in each of the banks. If you're a badly run organization and you've got information in silo A not getting information in silo B, and by the way, I don't know if any of you have had private sector experience, but companies talk about that problem all the time. Executives at the leadership meetings and executive meetings and talk about that problem all the time, that there's information in various silos that's valuable and we need to find a way to get it across. And I don't think they did. I think the credit guys in silo B knew that the underwriting standards in America had crashed in the mortgage market, and the rocket scientists in silo A did not know. And nobody got them to communicate. I think the first places that communication started to happen were, you know, maybe Wells Fargo, certainly J.P. Morgan Chase, and then eventually Goldman. Those seem to be the places where it got figured out, first of all. But in the rating agencies, I mean, the rating agencies, their competitive advantage is credit. They're supposed to know what's going on in the credit markets of the country. When I blamed the rating agencies, and the most recent time I did it was with Jamie Dimon, and Jamie said, well, you can blame the rating agencies if you want, but if all institutional investors do is buy things that rating agencies rate AAA, what are institutional investors for? The whole point of being an institutional investor is you're supposed to be doing your homework. And so you can say, if all that Joe Cassano was doing was taking the rating agency's word for the AAA-ness of these securities, then what do they need the rating agencies for? By the way, Joe Cassano, if you don't know this, is a credit guy. Joe Cassano was a credit guy at Drexel Burnham. When I worked with Joe Cassano at AIG, he was our chief credit guy.
Steve, could I ask you a couple of questions about the models that they used to price it?
Sure.
You focused on the lack of communication between the credit analyst and the mathematicians. There's also been a lot of attention on the models used by the mathematicians, this Gaussian Coppola or what other methods they're using. Could it be that even the math guys knew that this was subprime credit rating on each individual asset in the pool, but simply made some had a poor model and made some bad assumptions about the correlation of those risks?
I don't think so. In my professional opinion, the models, there are differences in the models across firms, but they're roughly the same. And the models, the mathematical models work correctly. If you plug in, if you knew with certainty what volatility was going to be, what foreclosures were going to be, what defaults were going to be in the life of the security that you're pricing, you would know with certainty what it would cost, plus or minus a tiny random error. And so I don't think there was anything wrong with the models. I mean, I know that it's popular in the press to say the models didn't work. The models worked fine. If you go back to 2005 and get and haul in a couple of the derivatives desk and plug in what actually happened to the defaults and the foreclosures and the volatility in the market, they will give you what the prices of those securities should have been, and they'll turn out to be very accurate, in my opinion.
Right, because I think they went wrong was when. Because back in 2005, the defaults appeared to be more random and independently distributed, and it wasn't until late 2006 that those defaults delinquencies appeared to be less independently distributed.
Right.
And then the assumptions of the model didn't seem to conform as well with the reality. But you're right. It wasn't that they were wrong all along, but they were wrong. When you had a non-normal situation.
If you and I believe that defaults and foreclosures are going to be 3%, you and I can agree on a price at which to trade a CDO tranche. And if the defaults turn out to be 55% on the underlying mortgages, if you bought it for me, you lose big time. You're going to get zero. Whatever you paid me is a total loss. If you tell me that you're not going to pay what I want for that CDO tranche in 2005 because you believe defaults and foreclosures are going to be over 50%, A, I'm going to tell you you're crazy, and B, you're not going to buy the CDO tranche.
What do you say to the folks that say, look, everybody understood that we're building these models, that, you know, these were subprime loan products that, you know, with much poorer underwriting standards than existed before, but they still didn't up their assumptions about default rates because they were projecting continual increases in housing prices that would preclude those default rates from occurring?
I retired in 02. We had a pretty tiny subprime desk. If that had been my desk and the head of the subprime sort of CDO origination unit had made that argument, I would have said that it was ludicrous. What I think happened is that the rocket scientists heard that and said, okay, well, then maybe the defaults and the foreclosures will be 6% or 7%. Mm-hmm. But it would be incomprehensible. Those guys, I don't know how many of those guys, I mean, I've hired those guys, and I've worked with them, and they're great guys. I mean, they're incredibly brilliant guys. I mean, I saw Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's sidekick, the other day, had a great quote. He said, the real tragedy in the world today is that all of the bright people in China are going on to be engineers, and all the bright people in the United States are going in to be financial engineers. And that's an incredible misallocation of resources, and there's some truth to it. I mean, it's the reason that the Chinese are going to build better products going forward. These are really, really, really bright people sitting there on those trading desks, these what you call the mathematicians, but they don't understand the first thing about making a loan, or the first thing about a mortgage. And they're not living in the same world that a lender at Countrywide is living in Yakima, Washington. Or Bakersfield, California. They just don't understand. And I think that if you went at them, they would say, okay, well, if you're telling me defaults are going to be higher, let's assume 6%. And then they'd do the pricing out for that. Here's the reason I don't believe for a minute that anybody on those desks got it. They wouldn't have allowed their own companies to hold the assets if they got it. One of the things that people are complaining about is these guys got paid a lot of money and not much of it. You know, they didn't have a stake in their own firm succeeding. Mm-hmm. The guys in investment banking at Lehman and Wachovia and Goldman and J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank and Morgan Stanley were probably getting paid half in stock, in restricted stock.
Right.
There's
right.
no way these guys, if they'd gotten it, would have allowed Dick Fuld and Jamie Dimon to hold those assets. I don't think they knew.
Right. Well, can I ask a kind of a related question, Steve?
Sure.
Matt, you might have run across this when you were working for AIG. One of the arguments I'm told as to why people did such a poor job of estimating the correct value of the different CDO tranches or just the or made the right estimates about the default rate on the underlying collateral was that some of the insurance companies, not just AIG necessarily, but other insurance companies writing a lot of the protection, even on corporate names, not just on the mortgages, were using actuarial probabilities instead of risk-neutral probabilities to price protection. And so the different models between the, if you will, the credit derivatives dealers who had financial models and the insurance companies with their actuarial models resulted in that insurance companies overselling protection.
Okay, can I tell you an off-the-record thing?
Yeah.
Right. It's going to get a big laugh out of you, and maybe it will or not.
I need a laugh.
Off-the-record. In 1992... I was actually head of sales and marketing at AIG Financial Products for derivative products. And I wanted to do a 20-year interest rate swap with American Airlines. And so I went to our credit guy and I proposed doing it. You needed credit approval to do it. And the credit guy said, no. And I said, what? Or words to that effect. This is American Airlines. And he said to me, I don't even know if there's going to be an airline industry in 20 years, let alone American Airlines. And I, that was thoughtful to me. I mean, I wasn't a credit guy. I never got trained as a credit guy. I was a finance guy. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And it was thoughtful, and it taught me a lesson. And the guy's name who taught me that lesson was Joe Cassano. That's why this is all incomprehensible to me. Joe Cassano's a credit guy. What you just asked me, I don't think, if they were doing that, then it's incompetence. Because these are trained credit guys. It's like if Moody's knew that the underwriting standards had crashed in the country and it was theirs, and by the way, it was their job to know that, then their rating these securities AAA was incompetence. And I don't, I don't think you're ever going to be able to, not you, I don't think we as a country are ever going to be able to legislate away incompetence.
No, I agree with you there.
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
I agree with you there.
Right. These people you're talking about,
funding cuts may,
they're mathematicians, they don't know anything about credit. And if they're credit guys, then their fingerprints on this are incompetence. And my own opinion is the credit guys weren't talking to the mathematicians. And I'm now being redundant, but credit default swaps enabled it to go on for a couple of years longer than it would have, and had the effect of the bubble got bigger and bigger for those 2 years, so the crash was higher.
Steve, could we, shifting gears slightly, I appreciate your insights into this sort of the internal management of these firms' problems and making better investment decisions. But I was wondering if we could just run a couple of other hypotheses by you. One of the things we're hearing is that one of the things that aggravated the crisis was that the way in which a lot of firms managed the counterparty on their derivatives book was that before the crisis they traded against credit thresholds. There was probably some variation margin payments, but there was a kind of, you might call, lightly collateralized. And then during the crisis, they changed, and they started demanding a lot more collateral from the counterparties, and that this added to the deleveraging because it started soaking up firms' cash and capital. Is that consistent with what you understand happened during the crisis?
Yes, the short answer is yes. The point at which they started demanding that collateral is almost certainly the point at which they started asking the question, wait a minute, if they've got this many billion out to us, how many billion do they have out total? So it goes back to my earlier
point. But is there any solution to that? I mean, if you're a bank and you lend money to somebody, you do a credit run and you know how much debt they have. But if you're just because you do a master trading agreement with someone, that doesn't mean you get to know all of their outstanding derivatives positions. And so, isn't that considered proprietary?
The way that should be done, and normally was done, is that everybody knew the counterparty exposure. Each firm knew the counterparty exposure to every other firm. And there was a limit. You would not allow yourself to be exposed more than X. And if you hit that X, you couldn't do more deals unless it was collateralized. And it feels to me, for whatever reason, that many of the firms, not all, but many, allowed those exposure limits to be too high. I mean, if basically Goldman's very existence was threatened by AIGFP's inability to pay off on the CDSs, then they mismanaged those exposure limits.
Right. Well, but if they were selling protection too cheap, wouldn't you be, if you will, incented to take that credit exposure if you were buying protection from them at what you thought was a very favorable rate?
Yes.
In other words, okay.
But but it's just another case of me being wrong. I mean, if my desk is exposed, let's just say I'm still running the Wachovia desk, and I've reached my limits against Deutsche Bank, and I want to do a big trade with Deutsche Bank, and my credit guy says, no, you've already reached the limits, and I say, yeah, but this is incredibly cheap. The answer should still be no.
Yeah. Even though AIG was at that point AAA?
Yes. Emphatically, yes. Capital, yes.
Capital A.
Yeah.
Well, another thing I was going to ask you about, if you had, was things we've been hearing, been thinking about. It looked like some of the other, take a market like this vanilla interest rate swaps. There seemed to be some periods during the crisis when credit spreads and interest rate swap market weren't consistent with market fundamentals. In fact, even recently, the spreads over Treasury turned negative for the 10-year interest rate swap. Would you consider that a sign of crisis or something that would make the crisis worse?
I don't think it would make the crisis worse, going backwards to your question.
Why wouldn't a pricing distortion cause some inefficiency?
Yeah, I think there's a distortion that's called inefficiency. I know that, for example, I discovered somewhere during the crisis that the credit default swaps on U.S. Treasury debt actually, that there was a spread, that there was an implied probability that the U.S. Treasury was going to go bankrupt, which struck me as being a market anomaly. And my only explanation for how that can happen is that it's a short-term anomaly, and it happens because people think there are rumors in the market and it's going to get worse. The only reason that I would sort of go short Treasury debt on a credit default swap is because I think the spread's going to widen and I can buy it back at a profit. So I'm taking advantage probably of an illiquid situation with some dealer. That's no reason to take excessive exposure to some other dealer, but it is at least a partial explanation for why in the short run you can get market anomalies and credit spreads.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular explanation for why the basis risk went up so much in the CDS market, why it was, you know, so darn cheap to buy protection during 2008-2009 relative to, for example, the corporate bond yields? If you did, you know, if you did like a Z spread, it was so much larger than the credit default CDS spread.
In 2008, 2009?
Yeah. In other words, you sort of buy the Treasury and buy this and sell the CDS and get a lower yield than just, you know, buying the corporate bond.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I mean, I'm tempted to say excess supply of credit default swaps, but I'm not even sure what that means.
Well, I think one guess might be that the creditworthiness of the protection seller is being priced into the credit spread on the referenced entity.
Well, that's correct.
That might be one reason.
I mean, that's the inside joke on trying to buy protection against Treasury, against U.S. Treasuries. Basically, if you really believe the Treasury is going to go bankrupt, you really believe there's going to be a long-term payoff from that, who's going to be there to pay you off?
Yeah, I heard Blankfein buys his auto insurance out of a trunk of a car in a Walmart parking lot.
Okay.
That's also off the record.
I promise not to repeat that.
I mean, this is very helpful. Any more?
No, that was useful to get the feedback on those hypotheses.
So, Steve, let me say one last thing, other than thank you for your time. We appreciate it. We are tentatively scheduled to have our hearing on June 30th and July 1st, and the commissioners are looking at having a panel of experts at that hearing, and so all of the experts we are talking to, we are asking the questions of, one, are you available, and two, are you interested? Should the commissioners continue to decide to have a experts panel, and so they have a pool of people that they know are available to choose from?
I'm looking at my calendar.
Okay.
If I'm available and interested, I'm going to, in the summer, I live out in the middle of nowhere in Colorado.
Okay.
And currently my mother-in-law is landing here on June 30th.
I'm not sure how to take that.
So you'll take it on the way out here.
Perfect opportunity.
Right. Okay, here's the way to take it. It will be because I'm...
Now you have to pay for your own hotel.
I'm in charge of logistics. It will be hard to make happen, but if actually I'm invited and you want me to come, I will work very hard to get permission from my mother-in-law.
Okay, great. Well, again, thank you very much for your time. It's been very helpful and informative for us. getting opinions from folks like yourself that are experts in this area. So we will obviously get back to you on the hearing once the commissioners give us more guidance on what they want to do in terms of panels and people.
Okay, well, I'm sure this isn't a surprising response, but obviously the more time I have to plan, the better.
Right. Understood. We actually feel very much the same way and always like to get decisions out of them sooner rather than later, so we too can get stuff done and have more time to do stuff. So thank you very much, and we will hopefully get back to you within a week or two at the latest.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. I hope it was helpful.
It was very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.